That kind of sounds like winter music to me. You know, winter is on the way, and today we're going to take a look at how to prepare your car for winter conditions. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Jim Ward back with me. Always great to see him come by. He's the service manager at Smart Motors. Many, many years of master certification and experience with all kinds of vehicles. We're going to talk with him about how to maybe when and how to replace your tires. That's one thing. We can talk about batteries, maybe what to go over for emergency equipment, what you need in the car. And of course, he's ready and able to answer your vehicle questions. So I hope you'll join in. What do you want to know about snow tires? What do you want to know about replacing the battery, the wipers, or the antifreeze? Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. And Jim Ward, welcome back.
Thanks, Larry. Wonderful to be here.
Well, good to have you back. So, you know, let's talk about tires. Well, what about let's talk about correct tires to begin with.
Sure.
Have the right tire on your vehicle.
And whether you need really dedicated snow tires or not is a large part of where you have to drive. If you live in town, the roads get plowed earlier. You don't tend to have to drive on. Rural roads are going to be prone to a lot of drifting. But even if you live in town, if it's particularly hilly in the area and it's a bad snow year, but by and large, people that live out in rural areas that get plowed later and have to drive over hilly terrain are the primary people that probably want to think about snow tires. And snow tires are not the same as mud and snow. Mud and snow in the tire industry, the tire manufacturers basically have standards for snow tires, and a snow tire is going to have a little emblem on the side of the tire molded right into the sidewall that is kind of like a little mountain symbol with a snowflake in it.
Okay.
And those tires have a stringent testing procedures that they go through that rates them for traction for taking off from stops, for stopping, for cornering, and how they'll handle. Mud and snow tires are just a name. They don't have any such standards that they have to meet.
Oh.
And that's really any other tire that's true of as well. There are, among the snow tires, there are different types of snow tires. There are primarily based on the kind of rubber compound that they have. Softer rubber tends to be a better snow tire, tires that don't get as stiff when it's very cold out, but you have to be diligent in the spring to get them off, because when the daily temperature is typically above 50 degrees, those tires are going to begin to wear very, very quickly. So you have to get them off. So if you're a person who's going to know that you're going to be a month or two getting them off, then you probably don't want to get the real soft rubber compound snow tires. But, and again, if you live in town and the snows are plowed, early and you don't have hilly terrain, you probably don't even need snow tires. But you do need to take a look at your regular tires. A tire that in May that we would look at that has 5/32 of an inch of tread, we'd say that's pretty good. You could maybe go to your next visit. But in the wintertime, that's not going to cut it in Wisconsin. And some of the big concerns are stopping distance. Winter or summer, a worn tire that's down to 4/32 of an inch at 60 miles an hour on a wet road, same car, a test driver that does this test, just put different tires on that car with different tread depths, it'll take several car lengths longer, 5, 6, 7 car lengths longer to stop that car with low tread depth, even though that's still legal and sufficiently okay. And, that would be great if you felt like you could have greater following distances, but in Madison traffic, you don't get to own much real estate in front of you, to be able to do that. So those are some of the factors that you really want to think about, that you want to have good tread depth that's well in the 6 or 7 range going into 6 or 7/32 of an inch going into winter.
Well, I know you guys at Smart Motors, for example, you put on a lot of tires and sell a lot of tires. What are the best places to buy tires?
Well, dealerships traditionally have been considered to be fairly high in the price range of tires. That's changed recently in the last several years, at least 5 years. Most new car dealerships have an organization called Dealer Tire. So various different dealers up and down the street where I am all have the same Dealer Tire trucks delivering those tires. That buying power allows us to be more competitive with some of the bigger brick-and-mortar places that are all over the country and have great buying power compared to like a single dealership like ours. So by getting our tires through there, we are more competitive. So it's a matter of taking a look. There are a lot of places that just do tires. They don't even do wheel alignment or any other work. Sometimes they have some of the best prices, but you know, we hope we're competitive at least. We hope we're always in there and have a shot. But, you know, you always want to shop around and take a look and compare what you're getting and see if you're comparing apples to apples. Most places, dealerships that work with Dealer Tire have a price match guarantee, but that's there's some rules to it. It's got to be within 25 miles. It's got to be a brick-and-mortar place, not ordering them off the Internet. So, yeah.
So, I was going to say one more thing about tires. Oh, I know what I was going to say about tires. We were something you and I were talking about before the show, and that has to do with my tire. The light on my dash came up that, oh, I got low tire pressure. Mm-hmm. And in my case, it's probably the spare.
And that's often the case. We see a lot of that this time of year. As you had mentioned, that light had been on earlier, and when the weather got warm, it went away, and when the weather got cold, it came back. Most vehicles that have a full-size spare, that spare has got a tire pressure monitor in it as well. So if you've gone and checked your tire pressures or narrowed them all up and that light's still on, you're scratching your head, that's probably it. Probably is a spare. And it is the kind of thing that this time of year in the mornings when it's cool, we see a lot of cars coming in with a tire light on it. It's when the temperature drops 10, 15 degrees at night, a tire that's just marginal will fall just past the threshold and flip that light on.
Well, Loretta in Eau Claire has something, I think, relating to tires, so let's go to her. Hi, Loretta.
Hi, Larry and guest. I have a question. Once I hit a bad pothole because of that highway, and I wrecked one tire. It just kept on leaking all the time, and it was on the side, and then they said I had to buy 4 new tires, not just the 1 or 2. And I was just wondering, is that a come-on, or is that really, really true?
Well, it depends. If you have an all-wheel drive vehicle, the relationship of tread depth to the front and the rear is supposed to be within 3/32 of an inch. So if you had, you know, tires that are down below 6/32 of an inch, a new tire is typically going to be 9 or 10/32 of an inch. Truck tires might be even as much as 12. But, you know, if it's an all-wheel drive vehicle or a four-wheel drive vehicle, if the new tire is going to be 9 or 10, then the rest of your tires need to be in the range of at least 6 or 7, because if you get too great a difference there, it affects the drivetrain. The all-wheel drive system, the differentials begin to bind up because of that difference. Some manufacturers' drivetrains are tougher than others, but all manufacturers pretty much recommend that you keep those tread depths that close to each other. So if you have an all-wheel drive or four-wheel drive vehicle, and that you might have had 3 other tires that weren't completely worn out, but if they recommended replacing all of them, that would be the legitimate reason why.
Yeah. Loretta, that happened to me, too. And
that
I had to re-
a bummer, all the $7,000.
Yeah, I had to do that. Happened to me, too, when I had a tire ruined and couldn't be fixed. And so then I wound up having to buy 4 new tires. But I have an all-wheel drive vehicle, so that's the way it goes.
One thing to keep in mind, too, though, is that when you buy tires, this is something else you were talking about, where to buy tires. Road hazard is a coverage that you can buy when you buy tires. Sometimes it's included. All of our tires, we include it in them. Sometimes it's an extra cost. But road hazard means that if you hit a pothole, if you pick up a nail or something like that, it's coverage for that tire. And typically, it may not be for the life of the tire. It may only be for a couple of years. And when you buy a new car, you would think that you would, but you don't get road hazard coverage on those new tires. But typically, it's always offered. So something to think about. I always used to say, never do that. One of my sons bought a vehicle, didn't listen to me, bought the coverage, and he went through about 6 tires in a couple of years. So I was like, he knew what was going to happen to him, I guess. I didn't, but so it's not the bad idea to take a look at the road hazard coverage.
Thanks, Loretta. Appreciate it. You can join in, too, by the way. Here's the number, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. Chris emailed, and he said they received a set of snow tires with a set of wheels they purchased. The tires have excessive camber wear. I'm not sure what camber wear is.
We're talking about a wheel alignment angle.
Okay. But still a good amount of center tread. Their current tires are nearing the wear bars but are evenly worn. Should they keep the all-season tires on or just use the winter ones?
Well, you know, that amount of, it depends on how much camber wear there is there. I mean, when we look at a tire, we measure with a tread depth indicator. We measure three different places, a center tread block and on each side. The tire really is only as good as the thinnest part of it. I mean, you know, underinflated and overinflated tires and a wheel alignment that's off, which is kind of like walking pigeon-toed. That's really toe camber that he's talking about is more the overall in and out swing of each independent mm-hmm. suspension toward the inside, toward the outside. Those will certainly affect how tires wear, how a car handles. But if that edge wear is really down to where it would be a worn tire, 3/4, 30 seconds, you know, that's a lot of what gives you the traction to start and stop. You know, the center starts to push snow and water out and helps keep the tire in contact. But if you don't have that edge wear, cornering and a lot yeah. of other handling is compromised. So without looking at it, it's hard to say, but I would say that if that side it wore is down to 3/4, 30 seconds, those are not going to be good winter tires.
Mike, who's driving through Wisconsin as we speak. Hi, Mike.
Yes, hello. So my question is about snow tires. I use snow tires all the time, and when I buy it, they recommend that I go down a size. So if my car takes 17s normal, they recommend going down a size to 16. And also the width, they recommend a narrower width. And I was wondering why that configuration is better for a winter tire. And I would like to take the response off the air, okay?
All right. Thank you, Mike.
And most typically, we typically do not recommend a different size tire. But with some vehicles, it can be kind of tricky. With some vehicles, you begin to have clearance issues. You know, they're having you go down a size. But that's – typically, we don't change the diameter. So, for example, if you're not – you can't put a 16-inch tire on a 17-inch wheel. Mm-hmm. So if you're not buying different wheels, you're not going to be able to do that. There are calculators. You can go online. And so we could talk for a long time, but I'll try to keep it fairly simple. A tire is described in terms of three aspects of its size. So a tire might be a 175, 65, 15, or 16, or 17. The first number is how wide that tire is in millimeters. So if it says it's a 155, that tire is 155 millimeters wide. The second number, let's say it's a 65, that's describing how tall the sidewall is. It doesn't mean the sidewall is 65 millimeters. It means it's 65% of the 155. So they take the first, the width of the tire. The second number is telling you how much of that is the height of your sidewall. The last number is going to say what diameter the rim is. And you can only put a 15-inch tire on a 15-inch rim. You can't go to 14. You can't go to 16. You can't switch those back and forth. You could buy different rims. There's calculators online that would help you take a look at you can put the different tire size in, and it'd have to be a 15 for a 15, but it will show you the difference in height of that tire. If the tire is much taller, then as snow builds up on that tire and you turn corners, you might have clearance issues with the fenders and the unfortunately, those wheel liners, what's inside the fender and around the tire, that plastic, that stuff they've tried to make lighter and lighter. It's not as durable as it used to be, and snow will tear it up something fierce if you have tires that come too close to it with a bunch of snow and ice built up on them. In some cases, vehicles that have extremely wide tires, they may recommend a somewhat narrow tire in a different size because they cut through the snow a little bit better, but that becomes pretty tricky. By and large, it's by far the exception when we recommend a different size tire at all. Typically, you're going to look for a tire that's the same aspect.
You know, I park in a ramp every day, and as I'm driving out, you know, there are other cars. As they're making these sharp turns, you hear this rubbing, or it seems like the tires are rubbing on the inside of the fender on many, many cars.
Well, and it may be that something's happened to the car. Again, so many of the parts on what we would call a front clip, your front bumper and the fender liners, there's plastic underneath that. More and more they put plastic to give you a better drag coefficient. Mm-hmm. I mean, they call them splash pans to keep things from getting on the engines, but a lot of it's drag coefficient. So one of the things that if you have a smaller car, particularly if you have a hybrid, you'll notice when you pull up to parking stalls that have like a curb area at the front, that it's very easy to slide that up over onto there. You hear this crunch and then hopefully you back away. But doing that very often starts to – it can break and loosen up a lot of that plastic stuff so that the plastic liner for the fender is not necessarily held in place. It can get a little loose and make it contact a tire that it otherwise shouldn't. So there's some of that damage can happen pretty easily, but that's probably what most of that's from, rather than people having the wrong size tires on.
We have many callers coming up. Just a reminder today, Jim Ward is our guest. He's service manager at Smart Motors of Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. Nigel O'Shea, our engineer today, Jane Rotunda, our producer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at vehicle maintenance today with Jim Ward of Smart Motors of Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in. Lines are all filled, so we'll go right to Scott in Maquoneago next. Hi, Scott.
Hello.
Hi, what can we do for you?
Hi, I have a 2014 Nissan Sentra, and it has to do with the heating, well, and or air conditioner. When I turn it on very low, it's fine, but when I turn the lever up to, you know, increase the heater air, I get real loud rumbling sound, almost like an old-time machine gun.
Sure, that's a classic. The fan that is in your ventilation system is what's called a squirrel cage fan. If you picture a hamster wheel, the rungs of the hamster wheel are actually little blades that are angled, and that thing spins, and that's what blows the air through. That is very prone to getting out of balance. Something as small as a tenth of an oak leaf gets in there, and it's going to throw it out of balance. I mean, you turn that fan on and turn it on high, it's going to go, and the whole dash is going to vibrate. And you would think there was something like a baseball in there by the sound of it, but really, it just doesn't take very much at all to get it out of balance. So, you know, you can get some debris that gets through the screening for the ventilation system and gets in there. Hopefully, it's not, but sometimes we find some mouse nest material that mice love to go in there too because they're trying to get to the heat. But that's what's going on there. Most vehicles, and a lot of times, I mean, it's on most vehicles, it's at least an hour of work to get the blower motor out. But most modern vehicles have a pollen filter or cabin filter that you can kind of pull the glove box out, and there's an access door behind it. And if you pull the pollen filter out, you can kind of reach down in there. But again, I often, you know, would take a cell phone and try to get a picture of what's down in there before I reach my hand down in there.
There you go, Scott. There you go. Thank you so much for calling. Dick and Cudahy, your turn now. Hi, Dick.
Good morning. Hey, we're in the market for a new car, and we're basically tied into Toyota. But my question is, looking at all the new model cars, they seem to sit so low to the ground. Now, Toyota told me basically that they have 8 inches from the ground to the bumper. But if I look at the car, it looks like about 8 or 10 inches back, there's like a baffle plate, which I think is an air deflector, that sits lower than the bumper. Has anybody have any real great problems with this low front end?
You know, we were discussing earlier that one of the common things, I mean, the reason they do that is for drag coefficient. You can lower the drag coefficient by keeping the car closer to the ground and having the bottom of it more covered up and not having cars as open or under the engine bay as they used to be. And it can be problematic, but not so much behind the bumper, but at the edge of the bumper and parking the car and scraping that on like a curb that would be in front of a parking stall is probably the most common issue that we see cause problems. The lower a car, of course, in winter with deep snow, the more likely it is to drag somewhat. My wife drives a Prius, and, you know, we live out in the country, so there's dedicated snow tires on all four corners of that car in the wintertime because, you know, it does sit very low to the ground. That being said, the last couple of winters have been pretty serious, and she's not had problems getting around. So they will go through the snow, but, yep, you know, depending on where you drive, that snow tires can make the difference between having marginal traction on deeper snow that's building up and trying to push the car up off the road.
Kind of like the Highlander myself. I have a Highlander, and you're up a little higher there.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go to Tim and Marinette next. Hi.
Hi. My wife has a 2014 Toyota Camry, and a couple months back she had her tires rotated, and the guys in the shop were perplexed by a low-pressure light that wouldn't go off. And obviously the tires have their pressure, and it kind of comes on and off. It stays on most of the time, but sometimes it goes off. How do I find out which tire that is, or what do I do about it?
Well, with a scan tool, you can hook up a scan tool to it to the diagnostic port under the dash there, and that typically will show you what the tire pressures are reading. Now, again, if it's got a full size spare, that's got a tire pressure sensor in it that might have been overlooked, and that could be causing the light to come on. And sometimes those tire pressure sensors in the tires do fail; they do malfunction and just won't read right anymore. Far less likely would be that the receiver in the car that gets the signal from the tire pressure sensors would fail. I can't say I've never seen that, but that's pretty rare. It's either that they've overlooked a spare that's got a sensor in it that's low on air, or one of those that, again, you can look at a scan tool and you can see what reading they're giving to that computer to determine which one's bad.
Did they check the spare, Tim? Do you know?
You know, I don't know. My wife, I would think, I mean, if it's a Firestone or a...
I would sure think so, too. That's probably not it. That's just too easy. But, there are, like, among the Toyota model line, there are some cars that have many spares that wouldn't have the sensor and some that have full-size spares that do. So, it's not necessarily for the technician working on it, it's not necessarily the same every single car and every single time. So I would think that they check that, but... Yeah.
Wouldn't hurt to check it anyway, but good advice there, Jim. Thanks, Tim. Appreciate it. You can join in too, by the way. We have some open lines finally again at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Randy and Ripon up next. Hi, Randy.
Good morning. I just recently had new tires put on my Ford Escape, and being a carpenter, I always have an eye for things that are plumb and square and level, and they recommended an alignment. So I said, okay, fine. But now I look at the front end from the front end of my vehicle, and the top of the wheels are tilted in and the bottom's tilted out, and they tell me that that's within specs, but boy, I can't see how the inside edge of that tire is not going to wear out.
Well, most normal camber is set up a little, I want to say positive, too much in, positive out, negative, to give better handling. If you look at, in some applications, not the roads you and I drive on, but if you look at Mickey Thompson off-roading and you look at those trucks that they run, they're way cambered in on the top for stability and handling. Now, if your alignment was off a bit and they adjusted it, it might have changed how it looks. And, you do have a good eye, obviously, because most people are not with the naked eye going to see that. But if you're used to looking at that, it is noticeable. You can see it. Typically, when you get alignment, you get a printout that tells you, and the best printouts are actually fairly graphic rather than just having a set of numbers that would be meaningless to a lot of people. They show the tire. They show each the toe, the camber, the caster. And they show the spread of the range it should be and where it falls. Cars will not stay right in that center. Alignment is a range. It isn't. There is a set point that's perfectly centered, but as cars get older and parts wear a little bit, they don't stay right in the center. You're not going to get all three of those alignment angles perfect. But, you should have got a printout, and if you didn't, I guess I would go back and ask them if they can show you a printout of that alignment, and it should show, is this camber way off at the edge, just barely within spec, or is it right in the center? Camber is not adjustable on all cars. At least not a simple adjustment like the toe angle adjustment is. It's sometimes going to involve replacing parts. But that's the first thing I would do is go try to get a look at that printout and see what was a camber right at the edge of spec or more in, and that's going to tell you what's going on there.
And thanks, Randy, for calling. Ben emailed and wondered, does the Toyota 4-liter V6 in a 4Runner have an interference engine?
That is a chain, I believe. The Toyota does have a couple of engines with timing belts that are interference, but I'm not sure what year we're talking about. If we're talking about a new one, it is not likely an interference engine. If we're talking about something back in the early aughts to 2005, you may have an interference engine.
And an interference engine is?
Well, that means there's a chain or a belt that times and runs the top half of the engine off the bottom half. You could think of it as a bicycle chain. On a bike, sometimes you'd be shifting gears and things slip and the chain jumps a couple of teeth and it's no big deal. On a car engine, if it's an interference engine and that jumps a couple of teeth, the pistons and the valves, the pistons from the bottom half and the valves from the top half of the half engine collide, and it is catastrophic. The engine's done at that point right now. So And a non-interference engine means that it's made with clearance enough that if it, you know, something breaks and they free spin, they don't collide. So, you know, there are, there are a few engines out there still that do have interference engines.
Bob in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Hey, good morning. I have a 97 BMW Z3 that I only drive in the summertime. It's got maybe 9,000 miles on it total. And, I mean, I don't need to change the tires, but I have changed the tires once. I was just told that just by age they will tend to get crusty or brittle or whatever the case may be, and then it can be unsafe. Is that true, or can I replace tires that almost look brand new.
Yeah. The Tire Manufacturers Association does recommend tires be replaced about every 5-6 years, regardless of miles driven or tread wear. Now, that's not the same everywhere in the country. A vehicle that's parked in the garage most of the time, I mean, if you've garage at home, go to work. Some people have a garage at work. You know, they park in underground parking or some kind of a parking ramp, and that car's not in the sun. It is primarily sun damage, but there is ozone damage that occurs to rubber, too. You can look at the sidewalls and see checking and weather checking, but you're not necessarily going to see all of that damage. So, again, if we go strictly by the Tire Manufacturers Association recommendations, they're going to say every 5-6 years. But obviously, a car that sits outside day and night, 24/7, 365 in southern Arizona is not going to be the same as a BMW kept in Wisconsin that's garaged most of the time. But we don't see tires fail due to age very often, but obviously a tire failing can be a dangerous situation, so you really do want to keep a close eye on it. One of the things, that they make a lot of products to put on your tires to make them look nice, tire shine products.
Yeah.
And Tire Manufacturers Association also say they do not recommend doing that. Those products will advance the effects of the ozone and of the solar wear on the rubber.
Thanks, Bob. Appreciate it. Carl in Hayward, your turn. Hi, Carl.
Hi, Mike or Jim. I got a question about the recirculating air vent. It's on, it's on my air conditioner. It's got a little circle type thing, and it recirculates. Two questions. One is, when do you use it? And the second question is, mice. If I shut my car off and I don't have that recirculating vent light come on, which means it's closed, can mice get into my system?
They still can, because the recirculation is not right at the point that the air comes into the ventilation system. Typically, that intake is going to be in front of the passenger side, kind of above the glove box in an area we call a cowl. That's where your windshield wipers are. And although it does have a grate over it, the grate has got openings that are probably roughly the size of a pencil. Mice can get through that. A mouse can get through anything that's about the diameter of a pencil. So, the first thought that comes to mind is, well, I'll just put a screen over that. But screens tend to collect tree debris and lots of other stuff, and pretty soon you're blocking fresh air from coming in, and that creates its own problems. Can even affect the life of the blower motor to do it that way. With mice, the deterrent is the best bet to, whether you're going to put things like naphtha flakes or, dryer sheets or things that they don't like the smell of in the area of that intake so that they won't come in. But that's the key to keeping the mice out. You're not going to keep them out if they want to get in unless you put something there that deters them or catches them or eliminates them some other way. The recirculate is something that you're typically going to be using with the air conditioner. You can think of this in the summer or in the wintertime. You're not going to run your furnace with the front door open. So you're running your heater in your car with it on fresh air is the same thing. You're pulling in that cold air. But one of the issues is that the car isn't your house. It's a small little space, and your breath and the clothes that we wear that get some moisture on them in the winter and the snow that we drag in on our boots creates a lot of moisture, and windows start to fog up. So anytime, almost every modern automobile, when you put it on defrost for the front windshield, when you turn that on, it automatically turns the air conditioner on. And many vehicles with automatic climate control will also put it on recirculate. A lot of vehicles, even with advanced climate control, will automatically switch the recirculate on and off. They've got humidistats in there to sense what the humidity is in the car. If it starts getting too high, it's going to bring in some fresh air to help keep the windows from fogging up.
So there you go, Carl. Thanks a lot for that question. Appreciate it. Robert in Toma will move to you next. Hi, Robert.
Hi. How are you? I have a 2006 Ford Escape, and the flly-by-wire steering motor on the rack pinion went out one time, and they replaced that before I bought it. And the ABS pump cycles on and off when I open the car door or anything when the vehicle's off. I just, you know, the ABS thing just running. There seems to be no reason.
Well, they're actually, on a lot of vehicles, it is, hybrids in particular, have kind of a different braking system. Although they do have a conventional braking system, they have a hybrid regenerative braking system as well. And that is a normal preparation function of the ABS system. There are actuators that basically are supposed to keep a number of cylinders filled with brake fluid and on the ready to have the hybrid brake system transfer over to the regular braking system on demand. And so opening the door is telling that car, you know, someone's about to drive it, let's make sure those things are pumped up. So that is a function. Every Prius will do that. And I'm not saying every hybrid does either, because there are different types of braking systems and different types of hybrids. But it's not necessarily abnormal to hear that. You open the door and, yep, you hear this little buzz. And, I mean, you could actually have somebody else open the door and have the hood open. And usually this is located more over toward kind of almost an area we were talking about with the air intake, but over toward the passenger part of the engine compartment, toward the back of that. And you can see it and feel it vibrate. But that's not necessarily abnormal at all.
And thanks for calling. Appreciate your call, Robert. Let's go to Mark in Brooklyn next. Hi, Mark.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a 2008 Chevy Suburban 1500, and I got two questions, if I may. I had a transmission shop put a transmission cooler in the front of it to help cool the transmission, because I have a 19-foot travel trailer, little camper.
Sure.
And he installed that, and he bypassed the cooler inside of the radiator because he said those fail a lot. So he bypassed that and just had the auxiliary only. While driving my trailer up to Minnesota, my temperature on my transmission was many times at 230 degrees or more. And I'm wondering what could be that issue. And then the second issue is when I give it gas, I hear a whine in the back, but as soon as I let off on the gas pedal, the whine goes away. But then I give a gas, and then the whine comes on. Any idea what that might be?
Well, the whine, typically on the final drive, the big gear on the rear differential is what would cause that. Now, some of that is not necessarily abnormal, but this sounds like you're describing something you haven't always heard or something new. You know, my best hope would be that the gear lube might be a little low. Maybe there's a pinion seal leak back there. You know, the worst case is that there may be a bearing or something that's starting to go back there. So that I would have checked out and not let that progress too much further. With a transmission oil cooler, when you do something different than stock, you can have some angles such that they might have gotten some air in the system. And so and it becomes a little tricky. That transmission, I don't know if that 08 Suburban is a sealed transmission or whether it's got a dipstick where you can easily check it, but a lot of sealed transmissions.
You can check it.
Okay, yeah. So I would do a careful check of that transmission fluid level. You know, that's something that they may have gotten off, which would be, you know, easy to do when you're putting in a non-stock part. And it may be that the fluid quantity at this point with a different size oil cooler may not be the same. They may need to do some rough calculation to figure out what they're going to need in there to have an appropriate cooling capacity.
Makes sense. Thank you, Mark, for calling. Appreciate it. Chuck in Wisconsin Dells. It's your turn. Hi, Chuck.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Say, I've got a 2008 Toyota Tundra SR5 and four-wheel drive. And I'm having trouble with the outside of the front tires wearing. Now, I had it into Toyota, and they did the alignment on it, and they said that there wasn't too much wrong with it. And he asked me if I rotated the tires, and the thing has got less than 50,000 miles on it. I don't drive much. And he said, well, you should rotate the tires every 10,000 miles. Well, I have never gotten 10,000 miles out of a set of front tires.
Hmm. Boy.
They always wear on the outside.
Hmm.
And I, you know, I'm stuck. I'm just about ready to order a new pair of tires for the front, and this is kind of expensive, you know.
Sure.
Yeah.
And that is extreme wear to go on 10,000 miles. When you say we are on the outside, or on the, you're not talking about both edges of the tires. You're talking about strictly on the outside.
On the outside edge.
Okay.
They just stripped the rubber right off.
You know, that I mean, it sounds for all of the world like an alignment issue. You know, alignment machines can get off. The calibration of them can get off. So I really wonder, you know, you can get an alignment check done without necessarily having to have it aligned. Some places will even do that as complimentary. A lot of places will have a charge, but it'll be less than a charge for a full alignment. Might want to get another opinion on that, know, because there are other things that can cause edge wear on tires, you know, hard driving, city cornering, but that's usually going to be the inside edge, not the outside edge. That is just really odd. I mean, to only get 10,000 miles, it really sounds like the toe or camber is off on that on the suspension for the alignment angles. But, you know, they're saying they found it to be on. Again, go someplace else and try it. Right. It's not a thing where a guy, you know, even though the carpenter that called in earlier said you could see that, you might be able to see a little bit, but it's not a naked eye kind of thing. And if the equipment that they're using is out of calibration, they're doing the best they can, but they're not going to get it correct.
So there you go. Thank you so much, Chuck, for calling. Julie emailed and wondered, she says, many newer cars have aluminum wheels that start corroding after a few years. Is there a preventive maintenance for this, especially for a new vehicle?
Well, there is. I mean, wheels can be waxed and protective coatings put on them, just like the paint on the car. And ultimately, after that corrosion doesn't look the same as it does on steel. It doesn't have the orange kind of color that you see. In fact, it goes kind of white. And by and large, it's usually just appearance, but that corrosion can continue around the edge of the what we call the bead of the wheel, the groove that the tire fits in. And it actually can make that seal somewhat porous-like and make the tires leak more than they would otherwise. So typically, the correction there is that we kind of grind that down. There's different sealants you can put on there. But in terms of the appearance aspect of the outside of the tires, yep, just like the paint and on all of the outside of the car, waxing it, putting protective coatings on will help slow that down or prevent that.
Somebody else wondered if they will ever bring back the Toyota Tundra circa 2005 model.
One of my favorite vehicles. You know, I recently I had an 04 that unfortunately creeping up over a quarter of a million miles I got rid of recently. I love old trucks. And you know, I'm right there with you. Boy, I sure hope they do. I doubt it. I don't think we're going to see that.
Okay. AJ in Columbus, it's your turn. Hi, AJ.
Hi. I have a 2012 5-foot-ton across ceiling, and I'm calling about the heating in the vehicle. So when you put the heat on, the heat will be coming. It'll come on, and then all of a sudden, it's cold air. And I've gone on the blog, and apparently this is a common issue with the Chrysler Tundra Country. So I don't know. Well, I've done a transmission flush, and also the coolant has been cleaned out as well. So I just wanted to know if there's anything else I can do about that.
Chrysler Town and Country.
Most often, that symptom of having the cooling come and go is related to low antifreeze. If I hear that symptom 99 times out of 100, there's a leak in the antifreeze system. It's a little bit low, and as your cooling system is not a free flow system, it doesn't flow continuously. There's a thermostat that controls, and so the coolant on the vehicle side of the thermostat and on the engine side will not be flowing for a period of time. And when the thermostat gets up to a certain temperature, it opens it up and lets it flow into the radiator to be cooled. And so low antifreeze can cause that. There are also, though, different symptoms. The heater core, which is kind of a small radiator in your dash that the radiator coolant flows through to the and as air flows through that, it heats it up, and that's where your heat comes from. If those get partially plugged, you can get some uneven heating and unusual situations like that. And with climate control systems, those symptoms sometimes can simply come from malfunctions of the actuators that control the doors that open and close that tell where the mm-hmm. air is supposed to go. It may not be opening the door properly or not holding it in the right position. So when antifreeze is flushed, it is easy on a lot of vehicles to get some air in there. So the technician does his job. He fills it up. He runs it for a while. It kind of burps and the level drops and he adds some more and he thinks he's got all the air out. And, you know, a couple of days later, you start having that kind of a symptom. It sounds like you had this symptom before, but I would, even though you just had the antifreeze change, I'd have him check the level again just to make sure some air didn't get in there. But if the level there is full, and if they test and find that the antifreeze is flowing at the right temperatures and the thermostat's working right, then that problem is going to be isolated somewhere in that heater box, either to the heater core or some of the controls that flow where the air can go.
And thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. Jim Ward, Service Manager at Smart Motors of Madison. Our guest, I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at vehicle maintenance today with our guest, Jim Ward of Smart Motors of Madison. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining in. Lines are all filled, so we'll go back to the phones. And Dave in Reway, I believe it is your turn.
Thank you. I've got an 02 GMC, 4.8 V8. And one day it started after the initial start, which started okay. After that, she would crank for 10 seconds, give or take, maybe 15, and slowly start. And it does that all the time now, except for the initial start.
By slowly start, you mean
it'll crank really good. Mm-hmm. It's cranking really well. And all of a sudden, it'll just start slowly firing and then take off.
So not getting gas or something?
Well, I mean, it's not getting appropriate fuel or it's not getting...
The fuel pump pressure is 50 pounds right off the bat, and it holds 50 mm-hmm. pounds for a long time after you shut it off.
So we've got good pressure coming up. Whether we're getting good pattern into the cylinders is a question.
Would it be possible that it's a crank or a cam sensor?
It is possible, something like that. Usually, though, when crank sensors go, we have a no-start condition. We don't usually, that can be intermittent, but it doesn't tend to start and then start slow most of the time with a cam or a crank sensor. One of the ways that we try to get to the bottom of something like this is to take a look at the cylinders on a scan tool, see which ones are misfiring, and do a little experimentation with moving coils, spark plugs, injectors to different cylinders and keeping track of where you moved what to so that you can find out if the misfire follows something. Because you've got good fuel pressure, this doesn't fit the typical symptoms for a crank or cam sensor. But at least that's where I would start in that process of elimination to try to see if you move around the ignition and fuel components, if the misfire follows and moves to a different cylinder.
All right. Good luck, Dave. Thank you. Mike in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, hi. This is my question is when the tires get a little old, they start making noise in the freeway.
Mm-hmm.
Which tire do you know it's bad, you know?
Well, it's the one way that's a pretty sure way to do it is to swap them out with the spare one at a time. It's going to be a little bit of work. You're going to have stronger arms when you get done with that project. you may also be able to tell by running your palm over the tread of the tires. A tire tread can begin to cup or feather, and that tends to be something you can feel with your hand, kind of like feeling fish scales. You know, if you rub your hand over a fish from front to back, you can feel the scales are fairly smooth. If you go the other direction, they start to pull up and it feels very rough. And a tire that has got a lot of noise is going to have a tread pattern that is probably going to be perhaps visually noticeable, but you could probably feel it with your hand. But if they all seem to feel about the same and look the same, then it comes down to swapping them out one at a time to eliminate the noise.
All right. There you go. Thank you, Mike. Guy in Verona, your turn.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a 1994 Chevy 2500 pickup that I bought new. It's got about 135,000 miles on it. And for about the last 2 years now, whenever, and I don't obviously run it all the time, when it sits for a week or 2 weeks, it'll leak some transmission fluid. It never leaks right away, and it usually will come down. Sometimes there'll be some dropping, but usually it seems to put out a couple of tablespoons at a time, sort of. I had a transmission shop look at it, and he couldn't detect any leak, and he said it sounds like it might be a torque converter. He says on older cars, when you leave them sit and don't run them a while, it'll leak out. He says I can replace the seals, but it may not fix it at all. And it just didn't sound like he wanted to deal with it to me. And the only thing I can add to it is a number of years ago I had service on it because it was getting older and had all the fluids in the vehicle changed, including the transmission. And while I don't know if it started right after that, I've always wondered if they maybe overfilled it, although it really doesn't show up on the dipstick. It doesn't seem to really go down much on the dipstick either, or at all. I'm kind of at a loss as to where to go with this.
Well, the question is it transmission fluid you're seeing? You know,
yeah.
Ultimately, that's what comes to my mind. There are dyes that they make that we put into the fluid, clean the bottom off anywhere we can see dripping, and it sounds like they looked and didn't see any dripping. But he's talking about with the torque converter, that would fit because the torque converter is in a place where the oil is going to come out where the bell housing meets the engine, and it may not leave much of a tracer. In fact, there's often a little weep hole there anyway because that's not a sealed area inside the transmission. So but when we put a dye in the transmission fluid, if he's right and it is coming out that torque converter, then it's going to be right at the bottom of that bell housing seal at the front of the bell housing. You're going to see the dye fluoresces under a black light, and you put these yellow glasses on, and it's glowing in front of you when you take a look at it. But transmissions are fairly sensitive to fluid level. So you start to get some shift flares and some either harsh shifting or sloppy loose shifting if the transmission's too full or too low. So it is kind of odd that you'd see that much leak and not see it. Power steering fluid can look a lot like transmission fluid. So if you pursue the transmission and you don't see anything, then the next step, of course, if power steering fluid got low, I'd expect that system to start making some noise too. But fluids, particularly petroleum fluids, a couple of drops on the ground spreads out and can look like a lot. It often looks like much, much more than really leaked out. But that's how we do it. We put dye into the fluids, run it for a while. I mean, you might have to run it a couple hundred miles. You could take it for a test drive and be lucky and take a look underneath it with the light and see it, or you might have to drive it a couple hundred miles. But checking, starting with the transmission fluid, and if nothing's found, then putting dye into like the steering fluid or the different systems on the car is really where we get to the bottom of that.
All right. There you go, Guy. Thank you very much for calling. Justin in Milwaukee, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a 2014 Subaru Forester, and I get a high-speed vibration on the freeway. I took it to Subaru, and they said I needed a road force balance. I did a typical balance at a different shop, and they said it was fine. Do you have any ideas about what might be causing that?
Well, could be road force issues, but typically most normal tires you can just balance with a typical balancer. A road force balancer I think of as a diagnostic tool. It can allow you to see aspects of that tire that have to do with how much drag it creates as it's hitting the road that can tell you if a tire has excess road force. That is not necessarily correctable on that balancer. Again, it's more diagnostic to tell you that could be an element or a problem in that tire. When you feel this vibration, are you getting the fine shimmy in the steering wheel, or you feel it more in the seat and not in the steering?
It's kind of throughout the whole car. You don't really feel it too much in the steering wheel, but the whole car has like a high frequency vibration
right
to it at around 70 miles an hour.
If that vibration is coming from the front tires, the steering wheel is going to vibrate. You're going to be getting a nice, but you're going to be getting a hand massage from the steering wheel. So if you don't feel it in the steering wheel now and you rotate the tires and you still don't feel it in the steering wheel, I think we've got a driveline vibration somewhere else and not tires.
Yeah.
But if you do rotate tires and you feel it, and the ones that came from the rear, and then you do feel it in the steering wheel, it is those tires. And at that point, I probably have those two tires checked on a road force balancer.
All right. There you go. Thank you so much for calling. And Doug in Superior, hello.
Hi, Doug. Excuse me. Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question regarding for my daughter's 2014 Subaru Impreza, and before she used to have a Honda Element and it sat a little higher. She gets nervous about the snow up here in such a low-slung car down there. And some friend of hers or somebody she knows told her she should get snow tires. Well, she's got good all-purpose radios on there now, and I've always been told that just if you put all-purpose radios on there, that should take, you know, that's as good as getting snow tires. I guess I was just wondering what your opinion was.
Well, it's not. I mean, it's true that that new tires, even if they are just, you know, all-purpose tires, more tread on them is better than less tread. But snow tires are, you know, they're tested differently. And something that has an M&S for mud and snow imprinted on the side of the tire is not a snow tire. A snow tire, the Tire Manufacturer Association has got the symbol, again, is like a mountain symbol with a snowflake in it. Those are the only tires that are tested for winter, snow and ice traction, for taking off from stops, for stopping, for handling and cornering, and they do give superior traction in wintertime. There's no question. They'll do better than regular tires are. If, you know, it is an all-wheel drive vehicle, however, and if she lives in town where the roads are plowed earlier, she might get around just fine with the regular tires that are on it that have good tread. But if she lives out in the country, has to drive in areas that are prone to drifting or hilly terrain, she's going to be safer and more comfortable and have better traction with dedicated snow tires.
So there you go, Doug. Thank you very much for calling. Jim Ward, our guest today, he's service manager at Smart Motors. We are going to take a quick look at the news, the weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. And then we'll be back with Jim. You stay with us. We'll be back right after this quick look at the news and weather. Taking a look at your vehicle today, we've got some maintenance and a maintenance expert here, I should say, Jim Ward. He's service manager at Smart Motors, and it's great to have him back. He comes by every couple of months to talk with us, and certainly more than happy to answer your vehicle questions as we move along today at 800-642-1234 or email at ideas@wpr.org. And quite a few callers online. Let's go to Dave in Vernon County next. Hi, Dave.
Hey, thank you. 2007 Toyota Sienna, all-wheel drive. 3 weeks ago, the differential burned out, the rear differential. $3,000 later, I'm told that I need to replace the drive shaft because the cause for the differential burnout was a partially seized up U-joint that's permanently attached to the drive shaft on this vehicle and can't be serviced separately. So add to the $3,000 another $1,300 that I'm going to be forking out next Tuesday. Needless to say, I've lost my faith in the Toyota brand. I've had several Toyotas in my life. I've also had a bunch of Chevys and Fords and even a Fiat 128 that, by the way, I bought for less for the brand new car than less than the differential on a Toyota Sienna is going to cost.
I believe that.
Yeah.
So how do you defend yourself, sir?
Okay.
Well, I wish it was as simple as saying I didn't make it, but you know any given manufacturer has designs sometimes that we scratch our heads at. You know, most vehicles have serviceable universal joints on the drivetrain that don't have to have a whole drive shaft replaced. And different vehicles have different durability of drivetrain components. A four-wheel drive truck is going to be quite a bit more durable differential than an all-wheel drive minivan is going to have. And unfortunately, yeah, that differential in the Sienna isn't going to take a lot of abuse from a binding drive shaft. So although I can't defend it, you know, everybody in our field at times will take a look at the design that comes out and scratch their heads. I have a saying I often throw out there that when I look at designs and it's not necessarily related to this issue, that But so many of the things I see that won't hold up to Wisconsin winters, I want to invite some of the engineers to come and spend a day at a Madison bus stop on a slushy day and stand there all day before you go back to the cubicle and design things for the state that you say are going to last here. So it's unfortunate, you know, the amount you've spent. Those are not inexpensive components, and although there may have been alternatives, you know, a vehicle with a lot of miles on it, you might have looked at getting a used drive shaft that they could test and make sure the U-joints were free on. But, you know, if you buy new, then you know what you've got. You know, you've got the warranties on it. You know, it's unfortunate. Any manufacturer can have a given set of failures like that that will turn someone's, you know, opinions the other way. But if you look at the whole of that product line and all of the failures and all of the successes, they still look pretty good.
Yeah. There you go. There you go, Dave. Thank you very much for calling. Jim in Shorewood, your turn.
Thank you. Jim, I have a 2003 Sable that likes to stall when the engine gets good and hot, and then it doesn't want to restart till the engine cools down. I've had a fuel pump replaced, fuel filter replaced, ERG sensor replaced, PVC replaced, PVC valve replaced. Nothing shows up in the codes. Any ideas?
Well, it sounds like they've taken an approach, quite a few different systems in the car, the fuel system. But here's the thing. When it doesn't start, it's lacking fuel or it's lacking spark in all likelihood. I'm guessing someone found it lacking fuel because of the things, the actions they took. But that's not always the case because some of the things, the EGR valve and some of the other sensors are not things that are necessarily related to not having fuel. So, you know, the first thing I would want to know is that someone did establish that when it doesn't start, we have spark. If we don't, an ignition module is not a real unusual, and coils too are something not real unusual when a vehicle's hot to keep it from starting because there's no spark. So, you know, without looking at it, I can't know. The things you've described make me sound like someone found it not getting fuel and was going after that avenue. But, yep, I'd have to start with that basics and do that test right at the point that it's acting up, catch it red-handed, and see what we're actually lacking.
Thank you very much for calling. And, Jim, you should take a look at the truck that is featured here that someone emailed in a photo of. Scott emailed, and he says he likes old trucks, so he sent a picture of a 1961 International C-120 Travelette 4x4, which was the first four-door crew cab manufactured in the U.S., and it looks like he's got it in really dandy shape.
I'll take it. I mean, you know, I look at this new Jeep Renegade that's out, and it's like, yeah, it's got that kind of retro look to it that I'm not getting one, but, man, I like it.
Well, let's see. Speaking of Jeeps, I think we had another question about Jeeps. I'll find that. We'll get to it. In the meantime, let's go to Shane in Richmond, Illinois. Hi, Shane.
Hello.
Oh, you sound like you're distraught.
Hello? What's going on, Shane?
So we have a 2008 Saturn View.
Okay.
And at about 1500 RPM, it starts doing this shuttering thing. No codes are popping up. We took it to a mechanic and they were kind of at a loss. They told us maybe we accidentally got some fuel with some water in it or something, but we burned all of that fuel off. So I was just wondering if you had any ideas.
And it'll do this just sitting in park. If we're just sitting in park and not driving along, we raise the RPM to that 1500 range, it'll sit there and do it?
I haven't personally tested that yet.
So, I mean, and that makes a difference. If it's under load, it can mean different things than if it's just sitting there in park or in neutral. So if there's no code showing up, there's no misfire that's hit the threshold that is going to set a code. That doesn't mean there aren't any misfires, though. So looking at it with a scan tool, looking at live data, can tell if there's more misfires on a given cylinder, and then you can start, you know, looking at fuel and spark on that cylinder. Something else that Kanaker with fuel systems, they can get varnish buildup in them. And a less expensive, less invasive approach to try is to use some fuel system cleaner. You want to be a little careful because some are solvents that are stronger than you want, but a good fuel system cleaner that you can actually, there are different types of fuel services, but again, the least invasive, least expensive are just pour-in products that you can pour in a gas tank and run through a couple tanks and help clean out the fuel system, eliminate varnishes, and see if that doesn't resolve it. But, if it doesn't, then I would want to be looking at this engine running on a scan tool to try to evaluate, if we can see some level of misfires that can cause something you can feel but doesn't rise to the level of setting a code and turning a warning light on.
All right. There you go, Shane. Thank you. And speaking of Jeeps again, I found that email from Kate. She used to drive. She loved Jeeps and used to drive one that she had to give up and is wondering what are the common issues that occur with a newer, like a 2017 or newer Grand Cherokee.
I do know that the 17 Grand Cherokee did not, and I'm not sure I can give you a lot of specifics, but it didn't test real high in quality against other vehicles in that class. Some of that was just storage space and stuff, but some of it was performance issues. And that, again, I don't know the specifics on a Jeep Cherokee, but I recall reading that about that model. I like Jeeps. I've always looked at them. I watch their durability of vehicle. You can take anywhere with a lot of them. But durability has been an issue. And so, Google that research a little bit and you can get down to the more specifics of why Consumer Reports, some of the other organizations graded them down a little bit.
Kurt in Prairie du Chien. Hello, Kurt.
Hello. Hi, I have a 2002 Chevy Blazer, the S10 model, and the cruise control will not work on it. It quit, and I've had a shop look at it, and they say that it could be multiple problems. I've checked fuses. I've even tried climbing underneath where the brake pedal is to see if there's something there it will not engage at all.
Hmm. Well, this comes down to some circuit testing, what we call pen testing, where you take a voltmeter and start checking from point to point when you turn that switch on. Is the switch supplying power, through the module to turn it on? And ultimately, it's, you could, like you were saying, looking at the brake pedal, the cutoff switch for the cruise control on the brake can get out of adjustment. It might be a little difficult to see with the naked eye, but a lot of times you're driving down the road and obviously you want to be a little careful doing any of this kind of stuff driving down the road. But if you put your foot under the brake pedal and pull back up on it and try setting the cruise control, if it sets, you may simply have a brake switch that's out of adjustment. But if that doesn't do it, and realistically, this kind of diagnosis is going to be testing continuity of the circuits and testing if you have power from point A to point B from one component to the other through the system till you find where your open is.
Yeah, there you go. And Kurt, thanks. Ed in Northern Illinois, it's your turn.
Hi, I have a question about Camry hybrid batteries. We have a 10-year-old hybrid and an older Camry that we're going to replace with a new hybrid. And I was just curious about the difference between aftermarket and dealer batteries, because after 11 years, when the battery on my hybrid started to go, I found a local factory that rebuilds them, and it was $1,600, and the dealer wanted $4,600. So I'm curious, the warranty on the one from the factory was better than the dealer.
And yep, Toyota, and you probably find that warranty, that the dealer warranty has changed. I think for the longest time, they just had it stubbornly set the same as any of their parts. If it was like a water pump, it was a year of warranty, whereas now I think they're a 3-year warranty. And depending on, many of the non-factory batteries are kind of like remanufactured batteries. The hybrid battery is made up of a number of small little separate cells, real similar to, one of those individual cells is real similar to what a lot of radio control enthusiasts use. To get them to work in the hybrid, they've got to be balanced and so tested. So in the aftermarket, there are places that will will essentially rebuild them, and there are places that build new ones from scratch. It's getting to be a more and more competitive market. As I said, Toyota has increased the warranty that they give on theirs, and by and large, the testing shows that there is longer life out of the original factory ones, typically than the aftermarkets, at least to this point in time. But, you know, depending on the age of the car and how long you plan to keep it, you know, that difference in price,
yeah.
You know, as is so often the case with older vehicles, you know, we see Toyotas with great durability. You know, some of the early 90s stuff lasting to, you know, 500,000 miles or more, but that doesn't mean that, you know, when you get up over 200,000-300,000 miles that you want to put that kind of money into it, or it's even wise to. So, you know, it's a valid option that's out there, but, you know, if you're going to keep it forever and run it forever, it's like with any machine, a Toyota usually has a pretty high resale value, and it's, you know, it's not because of the name on it, it's because of how long they last and the durability. If I was looking at used Toyotas that someone had for over 10 years and someone that always put aftermarket parts on it versus someone that always put OEM parts on it, you know, there's a difference in what you're getting. But again, you know, at high mileage, does it make sense to spend twice as much to, you know, yeah, put in the OEM battery? Probably not.
There you go, Ed. Thank you. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234. Give a call. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Bob in Fitchburg, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Yeah, thanks. I have a 2011 Camry, and I recently put a new battery in it. And shortly after that, my driver's side rear passenger power window stopped working. And I also have noticed, I haven't gotten that looked at yet because this happened very recently, but I noticed when I'm driving at night, occasionally the four different power window controls on the driver's side door, the three non-driver side door switches, the lights on them are flashing. Does that give you any ideas of what I might be dealing with here?
Well, sounds like there's a problem in that master switch. And I cannot recall which years had a recall, but there was a recall on the master switch on certain Camry models. So you might want to check the recall status of that vehicle to find out if that is a recalled switch. And even if it's not a recalled switch, actually the reason they recalled them is that someone had one of the buttons on it started to get sticky, and an individual consumer decided he would lubricate that so it wouldn't be a problem, sprayed some WD-40 on it, which unfortunately is flammable. The next time he operated a window, the door caught on fire. So what they did was basically did a recall to look at the switch, lubricate those individual buttons so that they wouldn't stick, so someone wouldn't be inclined to try to do that. But there are certainly other things that happen to the switches than that. And even if it's not a recall one, you may have a master switch there that's starting to fail.
Russell emailed, he wants to purchase a full electric truck to meet his needs. And of course, one hasn't come out yet. He wonders when things are coming out and if they'll handle well in our Wisconsin weather.
Well, I would be in that market too. I love the idea. I'm a truck guy for sure, and electric is definitely the way of the future. And like most new technologies, when it comes out, I'm going to be watching for a year or two to see how they do. I don't know that I think that handling Wisconsin winters in terms of the actual vehicle drivability is going to be an issue. Battery, you know, for all electric, cold is kind of hard on electric systems and batteries, but not nearly as much so as heat. Heat does a number on batteries much quicker down the southern tier states, whether it's a hybrid battery or a, you know, lead acid battery. Their life is almost half what it is. So the heat is just much harder on the chemistry of batteries than cold. Cold can cause your battery to discharge, but if you catch it in time, assuming it doesn't freeze, you know, it doesn't destroy batteries like heat does. So I wouldn't anticipate they're going to do bad in cold climates at all. You know, if you've lived in Wisconsin very long, and if you've lived in Wisconsin all your life, it's a challenge for every vehicle out there.
Yeah, absolutely. There you go. Erica in Lansing, Iowa, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Erica.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Sure.
Great. Okay, so I have a 2010 Honda Odyssey, and we've had the roller replaced on the passenger back door. But then what happens is it will beep. Like, you know how you can turn the back doors on and off with a little switch in the front?
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, if it doesn't seem to want to shut all the time, and then if it doesn't shut, sometimes it even sounds like it's shutting all the way, but then it'll just beep and beep and beep. And then they put it on their little machine, and it doesn't come up with a diagnostic code. And they said they could fix it, but they're not guaranteeing that that's actually going to fix the problem. I think maybe change the motor out or something. So you can shut beeping off by shutting off the switch, you know, on the, like, on the dash.
Yeah.
But then I wonder, if I leave it on, is it going to wear my battery down? Like, if the door doesn't shut all the way.
Well, if the door doesn't shut all the way, that is going to wear the battery down, and that is a problem. There should be a diagnostic procedure that'll be able to tell you specifically what that is. You know, the different control components for that door. They are a complicated assembly. Sliding doors are really quite sophisticated when it comes right down to it, and so I'm not quite sure why they were recommending a given repair. It may, and what often happens is you start to do your testing. You start to go through the flow chart on the manual, and you come to a point where you find something that's out of spec, not completely failed. Well, the indication is take care of that part and then move on, you know, and see if it resolves the whole problem. And if it does, great. If it doesn't, then move on the rest of the steps in the flow chart. So I imagine that's where they're at, is they found something that tested out of spec, and they're you know, the only choice they have is to say, well, it is justified. There is justification to replace this part, but unfortunately, since we're only halfway down the flow chart, we can't say that something else isn't playing into this and you don't have other repairs you may have to do.
There you go. Well, Joan called, couldn't stay online, but wanted to know about the transmission recall of the 2015 Honda CR-Vs. Is, if she's not having issues, how immediately should she take care of it?
You know, I wouldn't put it off. I mean, I may be incorrect on which recall I'm thinking of, but Honda CR-Vs had a recall for a rusty cable. That wouldn't be the same concern in all parts of the country, but it certainly would be a concern here in the Midwest and the salt states that we live in. And with any recall, I would really encourage anyone to not put it off. If you have a recall on a vehicle, the word recall has a specific meaning, but in modern speech, it's kind of become a vague word, and there are a lot of different things that fall under what we would call a recall. Technically, a safety recall on any given manufactured vehicle is forever. They issue that recall, and they'll be able to do it on that vehicle forever. When vehicles get totaled out and they have a salvage title and somebody rebuilds them, brings us back on the road, that's one of the only things that a manufacturer will still allow you to do is a safety recall. You know, you can't do other warranty work. You can't do some of the customer support programs, but that's the thing. These customer support programs that a manufacturer might come out with may be for a limited term. They may not be the same as a recall, but they get called a recall in popular vernacular. So I would encourage anyone with any kind of a recall situation, don't wait. Get out there, get it taken care of, get it checked out early.
Somebody else wondered about whether or not you need to warm up your vehicle in the wintertime before you drive it. You know, start it up and let it run for a while.
Warming up our vehicles is all about us keeping warm and comfortable. It doesn't have anything to do with the vehicle. Modern vehicles are designed to warm up the quickest if you get in them and drive them. You could have some concerns even, you know, that with direct injection, there's more and more manufacturers are going to more direct injection, you get something called fuel dilution in the oil that injection pressures are higher. And so when vehicles run cold, they run rich, and you end up with, and there's an acceptable tolerance. There is an amount of gas that's going to get in your oil. It will be more with direct injected vehicles, and it'll be more if you sit there and idle it that way because it's going to warm up slower. That's probably not going to be the difference of whether you get 100,000 miles out of it. It's probably going to be the difference of whether you get 300,000 or 400,000 or 500,000. But nonetheless, it's not immediately bad for the vehicle. It is marginally over the long term not good for the vehicle. And again, the reason we do it is so that we're toasty warm when we get in. The vehicle is designed to get in and drive. Now, if it's 50 below, 40 below, I don't know if you've ever seen 50 below. Yeah, warming that vehicle up for a little bit, 15, 20, 30 seconds is not a bad idea. But, you know, the seat heaters and remote starts are not popular, you know, because the car needs it.
Okay. On that note, Jim, thanks so much. You're back on December 19th.
Fantastic.
We'll do it all over again. Jim Ward, service manager at Smart Motors. He'll be back on December 19th. Tomorrow on Garden Talk, we'll take a look at fall fruits and answer your gardening questions. That's tomorrow at 11 and Saturday morning at 6 or online anytime. In fact, you can listen to this show online if you'd like again. I'm Larry Mueller. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network, so please stay with us right through the afternoon. You're listening to the Ideas Network.